This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's time once again for Time Magazine. Each week, we bring you stories created by a team of national correspondents, from entertainment to politics, from technology to economics. Time Magazine has it all. Coming up on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Time Magazine, and I'm your reader, Patsy, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the March 25th edition of Time Magazine, and now I'll begin with the cover article titled, "The Fight to Free Evan." On March 29, 2023, Wall Street Journal reported Evan Gershkovich was arrested in Russia on bogus espionage charges. He remains imprisoned in Moscow, a political hostage in his parents' homeland. Inside the Struggle to Bring Him Home by Charlotte Alter. Growing up in the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 70s, Mikhail Gershkovich and Ella Milman learned to be careful. Children knew not to repeat what their parents said in their kitchens. Mikhail recalls his father, who grew up under Stalin, offering a piece of advice. If you're going to tell a political joke, make sure there are no witnesses. Mikhail and Ella both emigrated to the U.S. in 1979, seeking to escape rising anti-Semitism and life under Soviet rule. They met in Brooklyn in the 1980s, got married, and raised an American family in suburban New Jersey. Their daughter, Danielle, took swimming and gymnastics. Their son, Evan, played soccer. Here we can relax, says Mikhail. Just find yourself. Decide what you want to do. Evan Gershkovich decided he wanted to be a journalist, a calling that took him back to his parents' homeland. He had grown up speaking Russian and wanted to use his familiarity with the language and culture to pursue his career. He worked as a reporter for the Moscow Times, Agence France-Presse, and the Wall Street Journal. When Ella worried about him writing articles critical of the Russian government or economy, her son explained that he was an accredited journalist, his mother recalls, repeating the phrase as though it were a magic shield. But it wasn't. On March 29, 2023, Evan Gershkovich was detained by Russian security forces while meeting a source at a restaurant in Yekaterinburg, an industrial city about 1,000 miles east of Moscow. He has been a political prisoner in Moscow's Lefortovo prison for nearly a year. The first American journalist to be accused of espionage in Russia since the Cold War. Gershkovich is not a spy. He has never worked for the U.S. government. The White House calls the charges against him ridiculous and classifies Gershkovich as wrongly detained. Russia has taken Americans hostage before, but an accredited journalist is another level in terms of what it says about the country's relationship with the West, or America specifically, says Gershkovich's friend Polina Ivanova, who covered Russia for the Financial Times. His arrest was a watershed moment that represents Russia's disregard for international norms, Ivanova adds. It wasn't that Evan's work had changed, it was that Russia changed. For his immigrant family, Gershkovich's detention shattered a belief that their son could chase his American dream in the country of his heritage. Perhaps the cruelest irony is that Gershkovich loved Russian culture. His goal as a reporter, family and friends say, was to depict in its full complexity a country that is often reduced to caricature. Instead, Gerskovich is trapped in limbo. So are his parents. 40 years after they fled Soviet Russia, their only son has become a political pawn in a new Cold War, a human bargaining chip for Vladimir Putin, as relations between the two countries cratered with the invasion of Ukraine. On February 20th, Russian courts rejected the latest appeal filed by Gerskovich's lawyers. He is set to remain imprisoned through at least March 30th, a year since he was originally detained. While the Biden administration calls his release a top priority, negotiations to free him have not made progress. Late last year, the U.S. presented a significant proposal to free Gerskovich and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, who has been held by Russia since 2018 and is currently serving a 16-year sentence in a penal colony on spurious charges of espionage, according to State Department spokesman Matt Miller. The Russians turned it down. Putin has expressed openness to a potential prison swap. The U.S. and Russia completed one in December 2022, exchanging the American basketball star Brittany Griner, who was detained in Russia for drug possession, for the notorious arms dealer Victor Bout. But there are significant obstacles to consummating a deal now, according to two U.S. officials familiar with the talks. Those officials say the U.S. isn't holding any prisoners Russia values highly enough to exchange for Gerskovich and Whelan. Putin has sought the release of the convicted Russian hitman Vladim Krasikov, who is serving a life sentence in Germany for assassinating a Georgian dissident of Chechen ethnicity in a Berlin park in 2019. But U.S. officials say Germany is not currently willing to include Krasikov in a swap. The suspicious death of Russian dissident Alexei Navalny in a Siberian penal colony presents an additional complication. Allies of Navalny alleged on February 26 that he was killed before he could be released in a deal that would have involved Gerskovich and Krasikov. A U.S. official familiar with the negotiations tells Time that no formal proposal for a three-way prisoner swap had been extended involving Navalny and U.S. citizens, but that in nascent conversations, Germany seemed more willing to release Krasikov while Navalny was alive. Now that Navalny is dead, Germany has very much cooled to the idea, the officials say. The political context also contributes to the challenge. Putin may be reluctant to make a deal before the U.S. election in November because he prefers that President Joe Biden lose to Donald Trump and is wary of making an exchange that might be seen as a victory for Biden, people familiar with the talks believe. They're not looking to hand the administration any wins, says a U.S. official. The administration says that Gerskovich's release is a top priority. Not a day goes by without intensive efforts from the State Department and others across the U.S. government to reunite Evan and Paul with their families, Roger Karstens, the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, said in a statement to Time. Gerskovich's family and friends have not given up hope. Pessimism is a quality common in Russia, Milman says as she sits in Danielle's Philadelphia apartment. The walls are decorated with illustrations Evan gifted Danielle over the years. A cat wearing a tie, a devil playing a cello, a joke sign from a cemetery that says, "Sorry, we're dead." It's the optimism that carries me on, Milman says. If you accept the negative, it's like the game is over. Gershkovich arrived in Russia in 2017. 3 years out of college, he had landed a job at the Moscow Times, an independent online newspaper that publishes in both English and Russian. He formed a close-knit group of journalist friends who lived in the same Moscow neighborhood, Christy Prudy. They hung out at hipster cafes, art exhibitions, and concerts. They joined Russian soccer teams. They rented a dacha outside the city where they spent summers grilling and winters cross-country skiing. The job was endlessly interesting. Russia was a place where journalists had freedom to maneuver and freedom to do lots of good work, says Ivanova. It was this exciting place to discover that he had lots of connections to and cultural knowledge about. When Gershkovich's parents arrived for a visit in 2018, Milman was struck by the country's transformation. The family walked through the Hermitage in St. Petersburg and sampled Evans Cafe recommendations in a new, shiny Moscow, as Milman described it. Evan was excited to show them the Moscow he had come to love, says his close friend, Pyotr Sauer. Putin's Russia has always been a dangerous place for reporters. At least 39 journalists and media workers have been murdered in Russia since 1992, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. But Gershkovich was an American citizen with formal press accreditation from the Russian government. He felt his own safety risks were minimal. Every year it was becoming more authoritarian, says Sauer, but you still felt like you could talk to opposition leaders. There were protests. You could travel. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, those freedoms were curtailed. There were new laws that inhibited journalists' movements and new rules about what could and couldn't be said. Many journalists left. The ones who didn't were constantly looking over their shoulders. Gershkovich himself moved to London, but he returned to report as often as he could. Reporting on Russia is now also a regular practice of watching people you know get locked away for years, Gershkovich tweeted in July 2022. He told friends he had occasionally been followed. If anything, the exodus of colleagues made him more committed to his work. He saw it as his mission to be back in Moscow, says Sauer. He felt like he had a responsibility to tell this story. Gershkovich was not in the habit of keeping his parents apprised of his whereabouts at all times. When he called on March 27, 2023, his mother had thought he was in London. He called me to reassure me that everything was okay, Milman recalls. He said, I'm delaying going back. I want to finish something. Milman was vaguely unsettled, but she trusted him. 2 days later, on the morning of March 29th, Gershkovich exchanged texts with Sauer about Arsenal, their favorite soccer team. They made plans to meet up in Berlin for Easter. There was no hint of alarm. We couldn't imagine that he would be taken off the street and charged with espionage, says Sauer. It had never happened in modern Russia. It seemed out of the range of possibility. That afternoon, Gershkovich was detained by Russia's Federal Security Service, FSB, at a steakhouse in Yekaterinburg. He was escorted out of the restaurant with his hood pulled over his head. Emma Tucker, the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, woke to her phone ringing shortly before 4 a.m. and knew the news was bad. Liz Harris, the journal's managing editor, was calling. There were unconfirmed reports online that the FSB had detained Gershkovich on suspicion of espionage, Harris told Tucker. Tucker had braced for this. The previous day, Harris had notified her that Gershkovich had missed his check-in on the Dow Jones Global Security System, a standard procedure on dangerous reporting assignments. At first, Tucker took the news in stride. His phone could have died. There was no need to panic. But later that afternoon, Harris said that Gershkovich had missed a second check-in. Editors were worried. After the second missed check-in, Tucker called Paul Beckett, then the Journal's Washington bureau chief. Beckett was at a dinner in D.C. The appetizers had just been served. He walked out into the courtyard to take the call from his new boss. "Paul," Tucker said in her crisp British accent, "Evan Gershkovich has gone missing." At that point, missing simply meant that editors hadn't heard from him. But Beckett began reaching out to national security contacts. By a little before 8 p.m., he had contacted a top aide to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, called the State Department's press office, and emailed Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer. Finer called back within the hour, assuring Beckett that the administration was taking the situation seriously. Around 10:30 that night, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Beckett and Tucker. The editors held out hope. "I kept waiting for the call saying, 'Okay, he was roughed up by the security services, but he's out,'" says Tucker. And that call just didn't come. Instead came an FSB press release announcing that Gershkovich had been arrested on espionage charges. "It was a body blow," says Almar Latour, CEO of Dow Jones, which publishes the journal. "It confirmed our worst fears. With the spurious allegations of espionage, the stakes went up," Latour adds, "and the level of complexity immediately became much greater." Tucker had been the top editor of the paper for only a few weeks. She had just moved from London to take the job, and most of her furniture had not yet been delivered. She sat on a stool at her kitchen counter and got on a call with a few senior editors. Together, they drafted a note to the newsroom, relaying what they knew. Beckett spent the next 36 hours wrangling government support. "It was important to us that the message come from the White House as quickly as possible that he is not a spy," Beckett says. Tucker embarked on a media tour. "Someone along the way gave us the advice that there are moments to be loud and moments to be quiet. And this is a moment to be loud," Beckett says. That became a bit of a mantra. The legal team at Dow Jones focused on getting Gershkovich the right representation, a challenge complicated by the withdrawal of most Western law firms from Russia. One hurdle was finding a good lawyer who also wasn't politically aligned in one way or another, recalls Jay Conti, Dow Jones general counsel. "You don't want that to be a signal." When Harris called Gershkovich's family to tell them Evan had gone missing, his mother was the one who answered the phone. "I've never experienced anything like it," Milman says. "It's a shock." Harris promised to call Milman every hour, whether there was news or not, and to update her as soon as she heard anything. "Time stops," McHale recalls. "It's hard to breathe." Tucker and Harris went to Philadelphia to meet the Gershkovich family for lunch at a tapas restaurant. "The meeting made the family feel that we were not alone," Milman says. "We were supported." In recent months, the family has been in almost daily contact with the journal. They hear from Carstens, the special envoy for hostage affairs, roughly every week, whether or not there are major updates in the case. Usually there aren't. Milman has seen her son twice since his arrest. It's the cages that stick out in her mind. In May 2023, when his parents visited him in Lefortovo, Evan was in a metal cage. The second time, that June, they came to one of his pretrial appearances in a Moscow courtroom. This time, the cage was glass. "We walked in and noticed a huge smile," Milman recalls. "We went and stood next to him, and immediately Evan was already talking and joking. The family had a brief conversation through the glass. We were laughing," Milman says. "Russians don't expect laughter in a court. Crying, that's what they expect. But we were laughing." Gershkovich writes his family upbeat letters about once a week. Over correspondence, he plays long-distance chess with his father and trades jokes with his mother. Danielle sends him gossip about family members and celebrities and does tarot card readings for him. Gershkovich spends time answering the mail he receives, which is translated into Russian and passes through prison censors. He reads Russian literature. Someone sent him a book of exercises you can perform in a small space using your own body weight. He tries to maintain his mental health. His primary focus, says his family, seems to be reassuring them from afar. U.S. Ambassador to Russia Lynn Tracy, who has visited Gershkovich 8 times since his detainment, says she's been impressed by his amazing resilience of spirit. Even behind bars, Tracy says Gershkovich has been keeping up with U.S. current events. "Whatever topic I'm bringing," she adds, "I always have to have a little more information for the follow-up question that I know I'm going to get." Lefortovo is notorious for conditions that can border on psychological torture. Most prisoners are kept in isolation so complete that guards make a special clicking sound as they escort prisoners through the hallways to warn prisoners from interacting in passing. Physically, it's fine. You know that you cannot be attacked by anyone. It's about psychology, says Andrei Soltatov, a Russian journalist who has been questioned at Lefortovo. The interrogations are excruciating. Long, slow conversations in which the questioners constantly reformulate answers in bureaucratic language in order to trick prisoners into incriminating themselves. For Gershkovich's family, friends, and colleagues, the ordeal has been a lesson in agonizing dynamics of international hostage negotiations. The journal has launched a task force and a media campaign called #IStandWithEvan. The arrest was a signal from Russia. "Welcome to the world of dictators where the rules are different," Latour says. "We have to make sure that this behavior is seen as unacceptable on the global stage." Russian secrecy laws governing espionage charges make it difficult for either the attorneys or diplomats to get clear updates on the legal substance of his case, and there has been little apparent progress on the diplomatic front. What we're seeing is the Russian government treating innocent people as political pawns, Ambassador Tracy says. While she won't comment on the status of ongoing negotiations, she notes that the Russians are transactional in their approach. This is hostage taking to trade for something. The extension of Gershkovich's pretrial detention through the end of March creates an added complication. Until the trial, it won't be clear exactly what alleged evidence Russia is planning to bring against him. U.S. officials familiar with the situation say they're bracing for the possibility that Gershkovich may face a fate similar to Whelan's, a secretive sham trial followed by sentencing to a penal colony. In a rare interview in early February, Putin suggested to Tucker Carlson that he was open to releasing Gershkovich in a prisoner swap and said that Russia is in ongoing dialogue with the U.S. I do not rule out that the person you are referring to, Mr. Gershkovich, may return to his motherland, Putin said. But Putin also appeared to allude to Krasikov, the Russian hitman imprisoned in Germany. Krasikov is not currently available to us, says a U.S. official familiar with the negotiations, who notes, in addition to the death of Navalny, the heinous nature of Krasikov's crime. The U.S. is negotiating with allied countries in an attempt to cobble together other offers, adds the official. Biden administration officials fear Putin may slow walk negotiations during a presidential election year. It wasn't a coincidence, one says, that Greiner was released only after the 2022 midterms. They're trying to maximize pain and political pressure, the official says. In the meantime, Gershkovich sits in Lefortovo, writing to his family and friends, carrying on his active social life from prison. He keeps track of his friends' birthdays and writes others with specific instructions for giving them gifts, which flowers to buy and how to deliver them. When Ivanova had a birthday in late January, another friend urgently requested to meet up with her, then handed her a bouquet of tulips. The note said, "From your friend who couldn't write the card himself." This article is with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Julia Zarthian. I'll turn now to the editorial that is about the article I just completed. It's titled "Fighting an Injustice." There are two moments in Charlotte Alter's cover story on the unjust imprisonment of American journalist Evan Gershkovich that I can't get out of my head. The first is a phone call between Wall Street Journal editor Emma Tucker and Paul Beckett, then the journal's Washington bureau chief at the time of Gershkovich's detention. The shock running through that moment, which Charlotte includes in her retelling of the hours that followed Gershkovich's arrest, speaks volumes about the unreality of his abduction into the Russian judicial system. Even after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, Gershkovich had continued to report from Russia regularly. He told his parents not to worry. After all, he was a journalist accredited by the foreign ministry. Gershkovich thought that status would protect him, even as he knew life there had changed. Reporting on Russia is now also a regular practice of watching people you know get locked away for years, he wrote on Twitter, now X, in July 2022. On March 29, 2023, Gershkovich joined that number, which includes fellow American Paul Whelan, a former Marine serving a 16-year prison sentence on false charges of spying. The recent death of activist Alexei Navalny in a Russian penal colony only underscored the precarity of their situation and negated the possibility of a prisoner exchange that could have included all three Charlotte reports. The second moment in the story that I can't forget comes at the end. This one made me hopeful. Anyone who reads Charlotte's story will see clearly that Gershkovich appears to have lost neither his sense of self nor his sense of humor. Even behind the walls of Lefortovo prison, he has found ways to share his love for others. Gershkovich saw reporting in Russia as a calling, one made all the more important because the freedom of Russian journalists had been almost entirely curtailed. That silencing is only one example of the pressures the press had faced in the past decade. 6 years ago, we recognized the courage and threat that journalists like Maria Ressa of the Philippines' Rappler faced by selecting as Person of the Year a collection of reporters and editors under fire, a group we called the Guardians. Their courage has not relented, but neither have the threats. According to a December 2023 report from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Gershkovich was one of 320 journalists around the world who are imprisoned for their work. That is the second highest number since the organization began counting in 1992. At Time, we hope our journalism leads to action. We set out to tell the story of Gershkovich's arrest and imprisonment and its impact on his family, friends, and co-workers in the hours and months to follow. We know that hundreds of people are fighting today to free Gershkovich. In October, he turned 32 in his jail cell. And on March 29th, it will have been a full year since his arrest on false charges of espionage. We join the journalists and their supporters at the Wall Street Journal, as well as our colleagues across our industry, in calling for his release. We look forward to the day when Gershkovich is free, back with his friends and family, back doing the work he loves. Sam Jacobs, Editor-in-Chief. And I'll turn now to the brief section of Time Magazine for an article titled "It's Trump's Party" by Eric Cortaleza. The MAGA movement's takeover of the GOP is now complete. Every 4 years, Super Tuesday makes for high drama as voters in roughly a dozen states winnow down the presidential field. This time, it only confirmed what had seemed obvious for months. The Republican primary was over. With a series of smashing victories, Donald Trump had effectively clinched the nomination. His last remaining opponent, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, suspended her campaign the next morning. While she didn't endorse Trump, most of the party was already falling in line behind him. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason, Trump told supporters in a victory speech at Mar-a-Lago. This is a big one. Trump's triumph gets him another step closer to reclaiming the presidency and pursuing a draconian policy agenda, unlike any the nation has ever seen. He has vowed to round up and deport millions of undocumented immigrants, reimpose his travel ban on Muslim-majority countries, purge the federal bureaucracy of civil servants and replace them with MAGA loyalists, force homeless Americans off the street and into tent cities, and commandeer the Justice Department to exact revenge on his political enemies. He also grows closer to squashing two of the four criminal prosecutions against him. As president, he could shut down his federal indictments, one for election interference and another for mishandling the nation's secrets. When Trump left office in January 2021, after unleashing a mob on the U.S. Capitol, few foresaw him engineering a one-sided victory 3 years later in one of the least competitive open primaries in U.S. history. But Trump and his allies did. They had a plan from the start to kneecap heretics and scare off potential challengers. Their success was never inevitable. When Trump launched his candidacy in November 2022, he was under a dark cloud. Republicans had just suffered a disappointing midterm cycle, with many of his hand-picked candidates losing critical races. The party's own top brass saw it as a sign to move on from the former president. Not a single member of Congress attended the Trump campaign kickoff at Mar-a-Lago. Trump's foremost priority was to neuter the man many presumed to be his most formidable intra-party threat, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who had just won a landslide re-election. Trump quickly went to work, debasing him with nicknames such as Meatball Ron and Tiny D, dispatching a brigade of online trolls to mock his campaign missteps, and racking up endorsements from Florida's congressional delegation. The attacks not only undermined DeSantis' attempt to pitch himself as a more competent version of Trump, they also sent a message to would-be rivals: be prepared to face the career-destroying wrath of a MAGA onslaught. His campaign was actually revived by the indictments, which Trump framed as an attack on his supporters. The maneuver enabled him to rise in the polls and raise millions with each new charge. At the same time, he cunningly used his ordeal to box in his GOP adversaries with a catch-22. If they claimed he couldn't win the White House because of his legal woes, he characterized them as part of a conspiracy to derail his candidacy. Yet, if they defended him, as most did, they only amplified and corroborated his central argument with Republican voters. From then on, Trump barely had to make an effort. He faced a weak field of rivals who were too timid to attack his greatest vulnerabilities. When Trump skipped every primary debate, he made the events seem like little more than auditions to be his running mate. By the time Haley took the gloves off, she had already lost in Iowa and New Hampshire and seemed to be mounting more of a symbolic anti-Trump mission than a serious presidential bid. But as she hung on, Trump and his allies branded her a warmongering neocon, even though her primary foreign policy experience was as Trump's envoy to the United Nations, and set out to humiliate her. In her home state of South Carolina, Trump won by 20 points. After Haley secured her first primary win in Washington, D.C., the Trump campaign called her the Queen of the Swamp. Even before Haley formally dropped out, Trump had already signaled a turn to the general election. He proposed a revamp of the Republican National Committee, installing new loyalists to lead the organization, and narrowed his attacks on President Joe Biden. The only remaining question was whether Haley would try to unite her supporters around Trump. Sources say she doesn't plan to endorse her former boss. None of that seemed to be on Trump's mind at the end of Super Tuesday, or at least he wasn't showing it. He never mentioned Haley's name in his victory speech. Instead, he focused on the last man standing in the way of his return to power. "We've watched our country take a great beating over the last 3 years," Trump said. "We're going to take back our country." And continuing the brief news with an article titled, "Spring Won't Bring Gaza Relief." The war in Gaza is entering its sixth month and its third season. More than 30,000 people have been killed there since the Israeli offensive answering Hamas's October 7th massacre, and some 1.9 million displaced people have endured homelessness in punishing winter weather marked by heavy rain and low temperatures. And while many may greet the arrival of spring as a reprieve from the cold, experts warn that the higher temperatures come with their own set of challenges, ones that stand to make the situation in Gaza even worse. Disease threat. Higher temperatures, besides bringing relief from the cold, can accelerate the spread of communicable diseases such as diarrhea and hepatitis A. "It's the perfect environment for a massive epidemic to take hold," warns Francesco Cecchi, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who specializes in disease control in crisis. Among Chechi's top concerns is that warmer weather could lead to a cholera outbreak, noting that Gaza's decimated healthcare system doesn't have the resources to cope with illnesses that require extensive rehydration. Malnutrition. Perhaps the most acute crisis is the dire shortfall of food and other humanitarian aid entering the Strip. Conditions the UN and others have warned will make famine almost inevitable. Fazia Alvi, a Canadian physician who recently returned from a medical trip to Gaza, tells Time she witnessed children who had symptoms of severe malnutrition, including some who she believes were suffering from rickets, a condition that often stems from dietary deficiencies. She also saw fungal infections and hepatitis A, the spread of which she attributed to widespread overcrowding. The children and the adults who escaped the bombing and sniper shots, they will die from the diseases. Predicted deaths. The situation continues to deteriorate day by day, the International Rescue Committee has said, noting that only a swift and lasting ceasefire would allow the level of aid that the people of Gaza so urgently need to survive. In a recent study, Chechi and his co-authors projected that even in the absence of epidemics, an additional 58,260 Palestinians will be killed over the next 6 months if things remain unchanged. That figure jumps to 74,290 in the event of an escalation. The way things are heading right now is consistent with our worst scenario, Chechi says, perhaps even a little bit worse than that. This article was by Jasmine Serhan. And now, good question. Why are users upset about Reddit's IPO? By Andrew R. Chow. Reddit users can move markets. 3 years ago, members of the finance-focused subreddit r Wall Street Bets, one of the platform's biggest communities, banded together to push GameStop's stock price upward in unprecedented ways. Now Reddit itself is hoping to tap into its users' unruly energy by allowing them to participate in the company's IPO. Reddit filed to go public on February 22nd, seeking a valuation of at least $5 billion. Crucially, the company said it would set aside a large number of shares for 75,000 of the company's most prolific users who might be able to profit off the company's financial success. But rather than galvanizing the community, the news was met with fierce backlash and pessimism from many Redditors who cast doubt on the company's business model, complained about recent changes to the site, and ironically threatened to wield their collective power to bet against the company's stock. The overwhelming negativity from Reddit's own community illuminates a fundamental problem with social media, where business models are often at odds with the people platforms ostensibly serve. Reddit is one of the most visited websites in the U.S., with 73.1 million daily active users. But the company is still unprofitable. While it grew 21% in revenue last year, it also lost more than $90 million. Compared with Instagram, X, and other social media platforms, Reddit has especially struggled to monetize its audience through ads, partly because its content is generally more freewheeling and untamed than that of its counterparts. Reddit is powered by users who post content and moderate the site mostly for free. And while Redditors tend to be intensely devoted to their subreddits, the subject-specific forums that make up the platform, many have grown increasingly disillusioned with the platform overall. Last summer, hundreds of Reddit communities engaged in a widespread blackout to protest price changes for third-party app developers. When Reddit goes public, likely in the next couple of months, it will be the first major tech IPO of 2024 and the first social media IPO since Pinterest in 2019. Very few companies have taken this route recently because of a turbulent stock market and high interest rates. As Reddit woos traditional high-profile investors, it also established a directed shares program, which lets the most active Redditors buy into the IPO early. But the announcement did not have the intended effect. Redditors responded with disdain, accusing the company of prioritizing profits at their expense. "They're trying to trick us into buying their stock to pump up the price," wrote one user. Another compared the program to a company throwing a pizza party for its workers, then forcing them to buy the pizza. A spokesperson for Reddit did not respond to a request for comment. r/WallStreetBets looms large over the IPO. If those users get involved, they hold the collective power to move the company's stock price in unprecedented ways. Reddit even acknowledged this in its filing, writing that the participation of Redditors could result in increased volatility. So far, r/WallStreetBets has not taken kindly to the idea. Many of them actually threatened to short Reddit's stock to bet on its failure. In particular, they complained about the vast difference between the compensation of Reddit CEO Steve Huffman, who received more than $193 million in 2023, including stock and option awards, and that of volunteer moderators who do the heavy lifting of organizing and overseeing the site's communities while making nothing. However, some super users retained faith in the company. One, who said his name was Kevin, but asked to remain anonymous over concerns about his job and personal life, wrote to Time that he planned to buy shares in the IPO, believing that the current negative sentiment was more a product of Reddit's tendency to devolve into hive mind as opposed to wielding expertise or insight. Every year, there are comments that the site company are going downhill from what it used to be, he wrote, yet it continues to grow at a rapid pace. A milestone, a first for abortion, a constitutional right for France. France became the world's first country to explicitly enshrine abortion rights into its constitution amid a rollback in reproductive rights in the U.S. and elsewhere. Following a final vote on March 4th, the bill was approved by members of parliament summoned to Paris by President Emmanuel Macron for a special meeting. The historic bill needed at least three-fifths of the vote to pass. Macron's government proposed the wording: "The law determines the conditions by which is exercised the freedom of women to have recourse to an abortion which is guaranteed." The bill has been well received across the political spectrum, with no major parties in parliament opposed. The move marks the 25th amendment made to the Fifth Republic's founding document. "We're sending a message to all women. Your body belongs to you, and no one can decide for you," said Prime Minister Gabriel Attal. This article was by Armani Saeed. Texas's scorched panhandle, a million acres swept by fire. The Smokehouse Creek Fire was named for the place it began on February 26th. The grasslands lining a tributary to the Canadian River north of Amarillo, Texas. But within days, dry winds had blown it into the second largest wildfire in U.S. history, a galloping, aptly named conflagration that by March 6 had burned 1.1 million acres and caused the deaths of two people. an 83-year-old woman found in her burned home, and a 44-year-old woman who died after being found outside her truck that had been overtaken by smoke and flames. Three other wildfires, the Windy Deuce, the Magenta, and the Grapevine Creek, also raged into the first week of March, taking in a few days nearly half as many acres as wildfires had burned across the entire nation in all of 2023. As of March 7th, only the Magenta had been contained. In neighboring Oklahoma, multiple fires burned more than 300,000 acres. Evacuations were ordered across the region, and at least 500 structures were destroyed. But in cattle country, most of the losses were animals, thousands of head lost among the millions that graze grasslands that had grown especially tall over the past year. Republican Governor Greg Abbott issued a state disaster declaration in 60 Texas counties. On the other end of the state, President Biden paid tribute to first responders during a visit to the border at Brownsville. When disasters strike, there is no red state or blue state where I come from, he said. There are just communities and families looking for help. He noted that Texas had received $13 billion in relief funding under his presidency, and that the frequency of disasters flowing from extreme weather has ticked up sharply. I love some of my Neanderthal friends who still think there's no climate change. And now in the brief business section, The Companies Driving the U.S. Green Revolution by Shaila Raghav. The blooming green technology sector has emerged as a beacon of hope, not only for investors. It's predicted to grow to $9.5 trillion by 2030, and for the many workers it employs, but also for the planet at large. Green tech companies leverage innovation and new business models to curb greenhouse gas emissions, displace unsustainable materials, and reduce the demand for non-renewable natural resources. A new statistical ranking by Time and Statista ranks 250 of America's top sustainability-focused companies based on their positive environmental impact, financial strength, and innovation to see who is rising to the top of the field. ZeroAvia, the top company on the list, develops hydrogen electric planes and already has 1,500 provisional orders for its aircraft. The most important action is to tackle the hard-to-abate sectors, such as aviation, CEO Val Miktakakoff tells Time. Yes, we can and will tackle the low-hanging fruit, like switching to EVs and building more renewables, but as that happens, we will have stubborn emissions in certain sectors that begin to make up a vast majority of the greenhouse gas impacts. Brimstone, based in Oakland, California, ranks fifth. The company produces zero-carbon cement, a groundbreaking innovation for the production of a material responsible for 5.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. With urbanization showing no sign of slowing, experts regard reducing the climate impact of cement production as critical. Marcelo de Oliveira, Vice President of Materials Science and Geology at Brimstone, tells Time that the green tech boom is as much about inspiration as it is about innovation, inspiring a new generation of scientists and ecopreneurs to deploy their talent to addressing climate change. Our most valuable resource in solving this problem is people, says de Oliveira. We urgently need more individuals dedicated to addressing it. What's most striking about the ranking is the diversity of types of company at the upper levels of green tech, a range spurred by significant government investment via the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. The industry now reflects major investments in the panoply of approaches that will be required to reduce the environmental impact of everything from food to heavy industry and develop renewable power from solar to fusion. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Patsy with Time Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.